This piece was brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, cane5.com. HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Health. Michael Spector's August 25th article, Seeds of Doubt, published in The New Yorker, has kicked up quite a bit of controversy in the anti-GMO and GMO conversation. We're on the line with Tom Philpott to get his response. Tom, what did you think of Spector's piece?
Well, Spector is a writer who has been extremely enthusiastic about GMOs for years and extremely dismissive about any concerns. And so I went into the piece knowing that. I wrote a review of his book, Denialism, 4 or 5 years ago, which I found to be a pretty weak book. It focused on science denialism, but never mentioned climate change denialism, which I think is the kind of number one denialist enterprise of our time. And so I went into it with I took it with a grain of salt. And the thing about it is that Vandana Shiva, like a lot of activists, she sometimes moves more into sort of passionate advocacy ahead of rigor. She's not always the most rigorous critic, and I think Spector has been able to seize upon some of her excesses to drive home, the assumptions that he went into the piece with, which is that GMOs are this important, vital technology to feeding the world. And so, in the end, I didn't really learn much from his piece. I already knew what he thought. It was obvious that he was no fan of Vandana Shiva. And none of the things that he exposed about her, I think she overstates the farmer suicide problem in India, and its connection with Monsanto. I mean, obviously, as Spector says, it's all about lack of credit, lack of access to funds. But one of the reasons why farmers need so much access to funds and credit is that these technologies that they're buying, like fertilizer, insecticide, and yes, even GMO seeds, are more expensive than farming without them. And so they are tied into the system where they need these chemicals and other inputs, and they need credit to get to them. And so I think that there is a broad connection between industrialized farming and the suicides that Shiva overstates, but it doesn't exonerate industrial agriculture as Spector seems to suggest.
So as we move forward in this GMO conversation, I feel like to the layperson, seeing an article published in The New Yorker gives it a lot of status or credence. And what do you think this has done to kind of stall or move forward the conversation for folks with regards to understanding what's happening as it relates to GMOs?
I think that's a very astute comment. I mean, I think The New Yorker is a very prestigious publication, and I think that it is very rigorously fact-checked. And I think there is going to be a portion of people who read that and feel like the debate is closed, that Spector has the answers and the Vandana Shiva is a charlatan or a phony or something like that. And I think that the reality is a lot more complex than that. So I think in that sense, I think it's unfortunate, and it moves to shut down debate when, just sort of by prestige of the publication, when I think there is much, much more debate to be had on this question.
And, I mean, how would you compare or contrast this to the work of Amy Harmon through the New York Times? Because I think we're seeing a similar kind of more pro-GMO stance coming out of that publication as well.
Yeah, Amy Harmon has, I think she also goes in the stories with a lot of assumptions that aren't examined. They also have someone named Stephanie Strom at the Times who I think writes with a proper sense of skepticism. I mean, I don't think she has necessarily a dog in the fight, but she doesn't take industry view as sort of gold standard. And one of the things about Harmon, one of her more recent pieces on the situation in Hawaii, where there's a big movement in Hawaii. I think one of the islands in Hawaii to banish GMOs, and she basically painted the whole movement to banish GMOs in the state as this completely irrational, silly, anti-science movement. And she barely alluded to the fact that in Hawaii, because of its geography and because it, you know, basically is sunny year-round, is a major testing ground for these GMO companies. And so you get 2 and 3 crops a year of crops that are testing, that are resistant to multiple herbicides. They get these big, you know, these huge fields in Hawaii getting rained down on with herbicides. And so a lot of the movement, you know, no doubt there are crazy people in the GMO movement. There are crazy people in the movement in Hawaii to ban GMOs. But they also have, you know, these people have a very rational thing they're talking about in their literature. And she basically ignored that and made it seem like they were just these, you know, these kind of crazies who think if you eat GMOs, you're going to get cancer immediately, when that was not the case.
Yeah, I guess I feel like that's the thing that makes me feel a little bit nervous about the shift in this direction, is that instead of kind of continuing to have a really substantive debate, we're painting one folks as, like, you know, secure science and another group of people as kind of fringe radicals. And that to me seems like the danger. You know, where should people look aside from hopping on Google and doing a random search and trying to distill it ourselves? You know, do you have recommendations for publications, or maybe can you direct us to some of your own work that you feel has been, useful in kind of getting a little more nuanced picture of this issue?
I have always, you know, I try to give a nuanced picture of my work no matter what, and have been doing that. And you know, I think you can look up my reaction to Amy Harmon's piece on oranges, which I think was about a year ago. And I looked really hard into it, talked to scientists, talked to USDA people, and said, hey, this might be one case where GMOs might bring a solution, at least for a while. No one thinks it's a permanent solution to this citrus greening problem in orange groves. But I try to bring a nuance. I talk to scientists. One scientist who I think is really, really good on this stuff is Doug Gurry in Sherman. And Doug now works for, I think, he was a Union of Concerned Scientists, and he recently changed jobs. But if you Google his name, Doug Gurry in Sherman, he might be at, he's either at Environmental Defense or Food and Water Watch. I'm not sure which. But he is a molecular biologist, PhD, who worked at the USDA when they were green-lighting GMO crops, and he's just got a really nuanced view. He'll tell you that, no, he doesn't think you're going to talk that if you eat them. And, you know, basically his view and my view are pretty similar, and that is that if you look at the challenges facing global agriculture and the challenges facing U.S. agriculture as part of that, there are a lot of real problems happening. There is this massive drought in California that looks like it's going to be a long-term thing. There's a problem in the Corn Belt where we're losing topsoil at an alarming rate, losing topsoil way faster than it's being reproduced in the field. There is, you know, generally speaking, we're going to have more drought, more heavy rain events. Obviously, populations are growing. And GMOs, if you look really hard at it, don't really provide interesting solutions to any of these problems. And there are a lot of things that are a lot cheaper. Research is a lot cheaper. Implementation is a lot cheaper that have been proven to solve these problems. I wrote about one of them last year. If you Google my name, and the name is David Branch. He's a farmer in Ohio. He is doing things that are, he's a, you know, big corn and soy farmer in Ohio, fifth generation farmer, not some hippie at all. And he's doing things with cover crops and crop rotations that are saving soil, making it more resilient to heavy rains, making it more resilient to drought, And he's using GMO seeds, but not because of the traits, but because they're the only seeds he can get his hands on that have, that the companies, their dominance in the market is so great that if you want to get corn seeds that have the latest genetics, and when I say genetics, I mean conventional genetics that, you know, are the most drought tolerant, the most established, the fastest, and things like that, your only choice is to pay the extra technology fee and buy the GMO seed. But he's not using them for that at all, but he's getting fantastic results from doing things that aren't GM that any farmers could do that are, you know, really critical to feeding the world going forward. So I just feel like GMOs are this false distraction from the real thinking we need to do about how to change our farming system.
Well, Tom, thank you so much, and we definitely look forward to connecting with you on this issue. As we can continue to look at this question of, you know, how we're going to feed 9 billion people by 2050, and thanks for taking some time out to share your response.
Sure thing, and you guys are always welcome to call me, or, you know, I'm always happy to be on the Heritage Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.